escaped. But as I crossed my eyes until they hurt in an effort to focus on the bee, logic did not exist. It was the bee that existed. Only that. The bee that had killed my brother. Killed him so bad that my father had slipped down the straps of his overalls so he could take off his shirt and cover Dan's swelled, engorged face. Even in the depths of his grief, he had done that, because he didn't want his wife to see what had become of her firstborn. Now, the bee had returned, and now it would kill me. It would kill me, and I would die in convulsions on the bank, flopping just as a brookie flops after you take the hook out of its mouth. As I sat there trembling on the edge of panic, or simply bolting to my feet and then bolting anywhere, there came a report from behind me. It was as sharp and as peremptory as a pistol shot, but I knew it wasn't a pistol shot. It was someone clapping his hands. One single clap. At the moment it came, the bee tumbled off my nose and fell into my lap. It lay there on my pants with its legs sticking up and its stinger a threatless black thread against the old scuffed brown of the corduroy. It was dead as a doornail. I saw that at once. At the same moment, the pole gave another tug, the hardest yet, and I almost lost it again. I grabbed it with both hands and gave it a big, stupid yank that would have made my father clutch his head with both hands if he'd been there to see it. A rainbow trout, a good bit bigger than the one I'd already caught, rose out of the water in a wet, writhing flash, spraying fine drops of water from its filament of tail. It looked like one of those romanticized fishing pictures they used to put on the covers of men's magazines, like True and Man's Adventure back in the 40s and 50s. At that moment, hauling in a big one was about the last thing on my mind, however, and when the line snapped and the fish fell back into the stream, I barely noticed. I looked over my shoulder to see who had clapped. A man was standing above me at the edge of the trees. His face was very long and pale. His black hair was combed tight against his skull and parted with rigorous care on the left side of his narrow head. He was very tall. He was wearing a black three-piece suit, and I knew right away that he was not a human being because his eyes were the orangey red of flames in a wood stove. I don't just mean the irises, because he had no irises, and no pupils, and certainly no whites. His eyes were completely orange, an orange that shifted and flickered, and it's really too late not to say exactly what I mean, isn't it? He was on fire inside, and his eyes were like the little isinglass portholes you sometimes see in stove doors. My bladder let go, and the scuffed brown the dead bee was lying on went a darker brown. I was hardly aware of what had happened, and I couldn't take my eyes off the man standing on top of the bank and looking down at me. The man who had walked out of 30 miles of trackless western Maine woods in a fine black suit and narrow shoes of gleaming leather. I could see the watch chain looped across his vest, glittering in the summer sunshine. There was not so much as a single pine needle on him, and he was smiling at me.
"Why, it's a fisher boy," he cried in a mellow, pleasing voice. "Imagine that. Are we well met, fisher boy?"
"Hello, sir," I said. The voice that came out of me did not tremble, but it didn't sound like my voice either. It sounded older, like Dan's voice maybe, or my father's even. And all I could think was that maybe he would let me go if I pretended not to see what he was. If I pretended I didn't see, there were flames glowing and dancing where his eyes should have been.
"I've saved you a nasty sting, perhaps," he said.
And then, to my horror, he came down the bank to where I sat with a dead bee in my wet lap and a bamboo fishing pole in my nerveless hands. His slick-soled city shoes should have slipped on the low grassy weeds which dressed the steep bank, but they didn't, nor did they leave tracks behind, I saw. Where his feet had touched, or seemed to touch, there was not a single broken twig, crushed leaf, or trampled shoe shape. Even before he reached me, I recognized the aroma baking up from the skin under the suit. The smell of burned matches. The smell of sulfur. The man in the black suit was the devil. He had walked out of the deep woods between Mauton and Caskwhackamack, and now he was standing here beside me. From the corner of one eye, I could see a hand as pale as the hand of a store window dummy. The fingers were hideously long. He hunkered beside me on his hams, his knees popping just as the knees of any normal man might. But when he moved his hands so they dangled between his knees, I saw that each of those long fingers ended in what was not a fingernail, but a long yellow claw.
"You didn't answer my question, Fisher boy," he said in his mellow voice. It was, now that I think of it, like the voice of one of those radio announcers on the big band shows years later, the ones that would sell Geritol and Seritan and Ovaltine and Dr. Grabo pipes.
"Are we well met?"
"Please don't hurt me," I whispered in a voice so low I could barely hear it. I was more afraid than I could ever write down, more afraid than I want to remember, but I do. I do. It never even crossed my mind to hope I was having a dream, although I might have, I suppose, if I'd been older. But I wasn't older. I was 9, and I knew the truth when it squatted down on its hunkers beside me. I knew a hawk from a handsaw, as my father would have said. The man who had come out of the woods on that Saturday afternoon in midsummer was the devil, and inside the empty holes of his eyes, his brains were burning.
"Oh, do I smell something?" he asked, as if he hadn't heard me, although I knew he had. "Do I smell something wet?"
He leaned forward toward me with his nose stuck out like someone who means to smell a flower, and I noticed an awful thing. As the shadow of his head traveled over the bank, the grass beneath it turned yellow and died. He lowered his head toward my pants and sniffed, his glaring eyes half-closed, as if he had inhaled some sublime aroma and wanted to concentrate on nothing but that.
"Oh, bad," he cried. "Lovely bad." And then he chanted, "Opal, diamond, sapphire, jade, I smell Gary's lemonade."
Then he threw himself on his back in the little flat place and laughed wildly. It was the sound of a lunatic. I thought about running, but my legs seemed 2 counties away from my brain. I wasn't crying, though. I had wet my pants like a baby, but I wasn't crying. I was too scared to cry. I suddenly knew that I was going to die, and probably painfully. But the worst of it was that might not be the worst of it. The worst of it might come later. After I was dead. He sat up suddenly, the smell of burnt matches fluffing out from his suit and making me feel all gaggy in my throat. He looked at me solemnly from his narrow white face and burning eyes, but there was a sense of laughter about him, too. There was always that sense of laughter about him.
"Sad news, Fisher boy," he said. "I've come with sad news."
I could only look at him. The black suit, the fine black shoes, the long white fingers that ended not in nails but in talons.
"Your mother is dead."
"No," I cried. I thought of her making bread, of the curl lying across her forehead and just touching her eyebrow, standing there in the strong morning sunlight, and the terror swept over me again. But not for myself this time. Then I thought of how she'd looked when I set off with my fishing pole, standing in the kitchen doorway with her hand shading her eyes, and how she had looked to me in that moment like a photograph of someone you expected to see again, but never did. "No, you lie," I screamed. He smiled, the sadly patient smile of a man who has often been accused falsely.
I'm afraid not, he said. It was the same thing that happened to your brother Gary. It was a bee.
No, that's not true, I said, and now I did begin to cry. She's old. She's 35. If a bee sting could kill her the way it did Danny, she would have died a long time ago, and you're a lying bastard. I had called the devil a lying bastard. On some level, I was aware of this, but the entire front of my mind was taken up by the enormity of what he'd said. My mother? Dead? He might as well have told me that there was a new ocean where the Rockies had been. But I believed him. On some level, I believed him completely, as we always believe on some level, the worst thing our hearts can imagine.
I understand your grief, little fisher boy, but that particular argument just doesn't hold water, I'm afraid. He spoke in the tone of bogus comfort that was horrible, maddening, without remorse or pity. A man can go his whole life without seeing a mockingbird, you know. But does that mean mockingbirds don't exist? Your mother...
A fish jumped below us. The man in the black suit frowned and pointed a finger at it. The trout convulsed in the air, its body bending so strenuously that for a split second it appeared to be snapping at its own tail, and when it fell back into Castle Stream it was floating lifelessly, dead. It struck the big gray rock where the waters divided, spun around twice in the whirlpool eddy that formed there, and then floated off in the direction of Castle Rock. Meanwhile, the terrible stranger turned his burning eyes on me again, his thin lips pulled back from tiny rows of sharp teeth in a cannibal smile.
Your mother simply went through her entire life without being stung by a bee, he said. But then, less than an hour ago, actually, one flew in through the kitchen window while she was taking the bread out of the oven and putting it on the counter to cool.
No, I won't hear this. I won't hear this. I won't. I raised my hands and clapped them over my ears. He pursed his lips as if to whistle and blew at me gently. It was only a little breath, but the stench was foul beyond belief. Clogged sewers, outhouses that have never known a single sprinkle of lime, dead chickens after a flood. My hands fell away from the sides of my face.
Good, he said. You need to hear this, Gary. You need to hear this, my little fisher boy. It was your mother who passed that fatal weakness on to your brother Dan. You got some of it, but you also got a protection from your father that poor Dan somehow missed.
He pursed his lips again, only this time he made a cruelly comic little tisk-tisk sound instead of blowing his nasty breath at me.
So? Although I don't like to speak ill of the dead, it's almost a case of poetic justice, isn't it? After all, she killed your brother Dan as surely as if she had put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger.
No, I whispered. No, it isn't true.
I assure you it is, he said. The bee flew in the window and lit on her neck. She slapped at it before she even knew what she was doing. You were wiser than that, weren't you, Gary? And the bee stung her. She felt her throat start to close up at once. That's what happens, you know, to people who are allergic to bee venom. Their throats close, and they drown in the open air. That's why Dan's face was so swollen and purple. That's why your father covered it with his shirt.
I stared at him, now incapable of speech. Tears streamed down my cheeks. I didn't want to believe him, and knew from my church schooling that the devil is the father of lies, but I did believe him just the same. I believed he'd been standing there in our dooryard, looking in the kitchen window as my mother fell to her knees, clutching at her swollen throat, while Candy Bill danced around her,
barking shrilly. She made the most wonderfully awful noises, the man in the black suit said reflectively. And she scratched her face quite badly, I'm afraid. Her eyes bulged out like a frog's eyes. She wept. He paused, then added, "She wept as she died. Isn't that sweet? And here's the most beautiful thing of all. After she was dead, after she had been lying on the floor for 15 minutes or so with no sound but the stove ticking and with that little stick of a bee stinger still poking out of the side of her neck, so small, do you know what Candy Bill did? That little rascal licked away her tears, first on one side and then on the other." He looked out at the stream for a moment, his face sad and thoughtful. Then he turned back to me, and his expression of bereavement disappeared like a dream. His face was as slack and avid as the face of a corpse that has died hungry. His eyes blazed. I could see his sharp little teeth between his pale lips.
"I'm starving," he said abruptly. "I'm going to kill you and tear you open and eat your guts, little fisher boy. What do you think about that?"
"No," I tried to say. "Please, no." But no sound came out. He meant to do it, I saw. He really meant to do it.
"I'm just so hungry," he said, both petulant and teasing. "And you won't want to live without your precious mummy anyhow, take my word for it, because your father's the sort of man who'll have to have some warm hole to stick it in, believe me, and if you're the only one available, you're the one who'll have to serve. I'll save you all that discomfort and unpleasantness. Also, you'll go to heaven. Think of that. Murdered souls always go to heaven. So we'll both be serving God this afternoon, Gary. Isn't that nice?"
He reached for me again with his long, pale hands, and without thinking what I was doing, I flipped open the top of my creel, pawed all the way down to the bottom, and brought out the monster brookie I'd caught earlier, the one I should have been satisfied with. I held it out to him blindly, my fingers in the red slit of its belly from which I had removed its insides as the man in the black suit had threatened to remove mine. The fish's glazed eyes stared dreamily at me, the gold ring around the black center reminding me of my mother's wedding ring. And in that moment, I saw her lying in her coffin with the sun shining off the wedding band and knew it was true. She had been stung by a bee. She had drowned in the warm, bread-smelling kitchen air, and Candy Bill had licked her dying tears from her swollen cheeks.
"Big fish," the man in the black suit cried in a guttural, greedy voice. "Oh, big fish."
He snatched it away from me and crammed it into a mouth that opened wider than any human mouth ever could. Many years later, when I was 65, I know it was 65 because that was the summer I retired from teaching, I went to the New England Aquarium and finally saw a shark. The mouth of the man in the black suit was like that shark's mouth when it opened, only his gullet was blazing red, the same color as his awful eyes, and I felt heat bake out of it and into my face, the way you feel a sudden wave of heat come pushing out of a fireplace when a dry piece of wood catches a light. And I didn't imagine that heat, either. I know I didn't, because just before he slid the head of my 19-inch brook trout between his gaping jaws, I saw the scales along the sides of the fish rise up and begin to curl like bits of paper floating over an open incinerator. He slid the fish in like a man in a traveling show, swallowing a sword. He didn't chew, and his blazing eyes bulged out as if in effort.
The fish went in and went in. His throat bulged as it slid down his gullet, and now he began to cry tears of his own, except his tears were blood, scarlet and thick. I think it was the sight of those bloody tears that gave me my body back. I don't know why that should have been, but I think it was. I bolted to my feet like a jack released from his box, turned with my bamboo pole still in one hand, and fled up the bank, bending over and tearing tough bunches of weeds out with my free hand in an effort to get up the slope more quickly. He made a strangled, furious noise, the sound of any man with his mouth too full, and I looked back just as I got to the top. He was coming after me, the back of his suit coat flapping and his thin gold watch chain flashing and winking in the sun. The tail of the fish was still protruding from his mouth, and I could smell the rest of it roasting in the oven of his throat. He reached for me, groping with his talons, and I fled along the top of the bank. After 100 yards or so, I found my voice and went to screaming. Screaming in fear, of course, but also screaming in grief for my beautiful dead mother. He was coming along after me. I could hear snapping branches and whipping bushes, but I didn't look back again. I lowered my head, slitted my eyes against the bushes and low-hanging branches along the stream's bank, and ran as fast as I could. And at every step I expected to feel his hands descending on my shoulders, pulling me back into a final hot hug. That didn't happen. Some unknown length of time later, it couldn't have been longer than 5 or 10 minutes, I suppose, but it seemed like forever, I saw the bridge through layerings of leaves and firs. Still screaming, but breathlessly now, sounding like a tea kettle which is almost boiled dry, I reached this second steeper bank and charged up to it. Halfway to the top, I slipped to my knees, looked over my shoulder, and saw the man in the black suit almost at my heels, his white face pulled into a convulsion of fury and greed. His cheeks were splattered with his bloody tears, and his shark's mouth hung open like a hinge.
"Fisher boy," he snarled, and started up the bank after me, grasping at my foot with one long hand.
I tore free, turned, and threw my fishing pole at him. He batted it down easily, but it tangled his feet up somehow, and he went to his knees. I didn't wait to see any more. I turned and bolted to the top of the slope. I almost slipped at the very top, but managed to grab one of the support struts running beneath the bridge and saved myself.
"You can't get away, Fisher boy," he cried from behind me. He sounded furious, but he also sounded as if he were laughing. "It takes more than a mouthful of trout to fill me up."
"Leave me alone," I screamed back at him. I grabbed the bridge's railing and threw myself over it in a clumsy somersault, filling my hands with splinters and bumping my head so hard on the boards when I came down that I saw stars. I rolled over onto my belly and began crawling. I lurched to my feet just before I got to the end of the bridge, stumbled once, found my rhythm, and then began to run. I ran as only 9-year-old boys can run, which is like the wind. It felt as if my feet only touched the ground with every third or fourth stride, and for all I know, that may be true. I ran straight up the right-hand wheel rut in the road, ran until my temples pounded and my eyes pulsed in their sockets, ran until I had a hot stitch in my left side from the bottom of my ribs to my armpit, ran until I could taste blood and something like metal shavings in the back of my throat. When I couldn't run anymore, I stumbled to a stop and looked back over my shoulder, puffing and blowing like a wind-broke horse. I was convinced I would see him standing right there behind me in his natty black suit, the watch chain a glittering loop across his vest and not a hair out of place. But he was gone. The road stretching back toward Castle Stream between the darkly massed pines and spruces was empty. And yet I sensed him somewhere near in those woods, watching me with his grass-fire eyes, smelling of burnt matches and roasted fish. I turned and began walking as fast as I could, limping a little. I'd pull muscles in both legs, and when I got out of bed the next morning, I was so sore I could barely walk. I didn't notice those things then, though. I just kept looking over my shoulder, needing again and again to verify that the road behind me was still empty. It was, each time I looked, but those backward glances seemed to increase my fear rather than lessening it. The firs looked darker, massier, and I kept imagining what lay behind the trees which marched beside the road, long, tangled corridors of forest, leg-breaking deadfalls, ravines where anything might live. Until that Saturday in 1914, I had thought that bears were the worst thing the forest could hold. Now, I knew better. A mile or so further up the road, just beyond the place where it came out of the woods and joined the Gagan Flat Road, I saw my father walking toward me and whistling the old oaken bucket. He was carrying his own rod, the one with the fancy spinning reel from Monkey Ward. In his other hand, he had his creel, the one with the ribbon my mother had woven through the handle back when Dan was still alive. "Dedicated to Jesus," that ribbon said. I'd been walking, but when I saw him, I started to run again, screaming, "Dad! Dad! Dad!" at the top of my lungs, and staggering from side to side on my tired, sprung legs like a drunken sailor. The expression of surprise on his face when he recognized me might have been comical under other circumstances, but not under these. He dropped his rod and creel into the road without so much as a downward glance at them, and ran to me. It was the fastest I ever saw my dad run in his life. When we came together, it was a wonder the impact didn't knock us both senseless, and I struck my face on his belt buckle hard enough to start a little nosebleed. I didn't notice that until later, though. Right then, I only reached out my arms and clutched him as hard as I could. I held on and rubbed my hot face back and forth against his belly, covering his old blue work shirt with blood and tears and snot.
"Gary, what is it? What's happened? Are you all right?"
"Ma's dead," I sobbed. "I met a man in the woods and he told me Ma's dead. She got stung by a bee, and it swelled her all up just like what happened to Dan, and she's dead. She's on the kitchen floor, and Candy Bill licked the tears off her.
Face was the last word I had to say, but by then my chest was hitching so bad I couldn't get it out. My tears were flowing again, and my dad's startled, frightened face had blurred into three overlapping images. I began to howl, not like a little kid who's scun his knee, but like a dog that's seen something bad by moonlight, and my father pressed my head against his hard, flat stomach again. I slipped out from under his hand, though, and looked back over my shoulder. I wanted to make sure the man in the black suit wasn't coming. There was no sign of him. The road winding back into the woods was completely empty. I promised myself I would never go back down that road again, not ever, no matter what, and I suppose now God's greatest blessing to his creatures below is that they can't see the future. It might have broken my mind if I had known I would be going back down that road, and not 2 hours later. For that moment, though, I was only relieved to see we were still alone. Then I thought of my mother, my beautiful, dead mother, and laid my face back against my father's stomach and bawled some more. "Gary, listen to me," he said a moment or two later. I went on bawling. He gave me a little longer to do that, then reached down and lifted my chin so he could look into my face and I could look into his. "Your mom's fine," he said. I could only look at him with tears streaming down my cheeks. I didn't believe him. "I don't know who told you different, or what kind of dirty dog would want to put a scare like that into a little boy, but I swear to God your mother's fine."
But he said..."
"I don't care what he said. I got back from Eversham's earlier than I expected. He doesn't want to sell any cows, it's all just talk, and decided I had time to catch up with you.
I got my pole and my creel, and your mother made us a couple of jelly foldovers. Her new bread. Still warm. So she was fine half an hour ago, Gary, and there's nobody knows any different that's come from this direction, I guarantee you. Not in just half an hour's time. He looked over my shoulder. Who was this man? And where was he? I'm going to find him and thrash him within an inch of his life. I thought a thousand things in just 2 seconds. That's what it seemed like anyway. But the last thing I thought was the most powerful. If my dad met up with the man in the black suit, I didn't think my dad would be the one to do the thrashing or the walking away. I kept remembering those long white fingers and the talons at the ends of them. Gary? I don't know that I remember, I said. Were you where the stream splits? The big rock? I could never lie to my father when he asked a direct question, not to save his life or mine. Yes, but don't go down there. I seized his arm with both hands and tugged it hard. Please don't. He was a scary man. Inspiration struck like an illuminating lightning bolt. I think he had a gun. He looked at me thoughtfully. Maybe there wasn't a man, he said, lifting his voice a little on the last word and turning it into something that was almost, but not quite, a question. Maybe you fell asleep while you were fishing, son, and had a bad dream, like the ones you had about Danny last winter. I had had a lot of bad dreams about Dan last winter, dreams where I would open the door to our closet or to the dark, fruity interior of the cider shed and see him standing there and looking at me out of his purple, strangulated face. From many of these dreams, I had awakened screaming and awakened my parents as well. I'd fallen asleep on the bank of the stream for a little while, too, dozed off anyway. But I hadn't dreamed, and I was sure I had awakened just before the man in the black suit clapped the bee dead, sending it tumbling off my nose and into my lap. I hadn't dreamed him the way I had dreamed Dan, I was quite sure of that, although my meeting with him had already attained a dreamlike quality in my mind, as I suppose supernatural occurrences always must. But if my dad thought that the man had only existed in my own head, that might be better. Better for him. It might have been, I guess, I said. Well, we ought to go back and find your rod and your creel. He actually started in that direction, and I had to tug frantically at his arm to stop him again and turn him back toward me. Later, I said. Please, Dad, I want to see Mother. I've got to see her with my own eyes. He thought that over, then nodded. Yes, I suppose you do. We'll go home first and get your rod and creel later. So we walked back to the farm together, my father with his fishpole propped on his shoulder, just like one of my friends, me carrying his creel, both of us eating folded over slices of my mother's bread smeared with blackcurrant jam. Did you catch anything? He asked as we came in sight of the barn. Yes, sir, I said. A rainbow. Pretty good sized. And a brookie that was a lot bigger, I thought, but didn't say. Biggest one I ever saw, to tell the truth, but I don't have that one to show you, Dad. I gave that one to the man in the black suit so he wouldn't eat me. And it worked. But just barely. That's all? Nothing else? Well, after I caught it, I fell asleep. This was not really an answer, but not really a lie, either. Lucky you didn't lose your pole. You didn't, did you, Gary? No, sir, I said very reluctantly. Lying about that would do no good even if I'd been able to think up a whopper. Not if he was set on going back to get my creel anyway, and I could see by his face that he was. Up ahead, Candy Bill came racing out of the back door, barking his shrill bark and wagging his whole rear end back and forth the way Scotties do when they're excited. I couldn't wait any longer. Hope and anxiety bubbled up in my throat like foam. I broke away from my father and ran to the house, still lugging his creel and still convinced, in my heart of hearts, that I was going to find my mother dead on the kitchen floor with her face swelled and purple like Dan's had been when my father carried him in from the west field, crying and calling the name of Jesus. But she was standing at the counter, just as well and fine as when I'd left her, humming a song as she shelled peas into a bowl. She looked around at me, first in surprise, and then in fright as she took in my wide eyes and pale cheeks. "Gary, what is it? What's the matter?" I didn't answer, only ran to her and covered her with kisses. At some point my father came in and said, "Don't worry, Lo. He's all right. He just had one of his bad dreams down there by the brook." "Pray God it's the last of them," she said, and hugged me tighter, while Candy Bill danced around our feet, barking his shrill bark. "You don't have to come with me if you don't want to, Gary," my father said, although he had already made it clear that he thought I should. That I should go back. That I should face my fears, I suppose folks would say nowadays. That's very well for fearful things that are make-believe, but 2 hours hadn't done much to change my conviction that the man in the black suit had been real. I wouldn't be able to convince my father of that, though. I don't think there was a 9-year-old that ever lived who would have been able to convince his father he'd seen the devil come walking out of the woods in a black suit. "I'll come," I said. I had walked out of the house to join him before he left, mustering all my courage in order to get my feet moving, and now we were standing by the chopping block in the side yard, not far from the woodpile. "What you got behind your back?" he asked. I brought it out slowly. I would go with him, and I would hope the man in the black suit with the arrow straight part down the left side of his head was gone, but if he wasn't, I wanted to be prepared. As prepared as I could be, anyway. I had the family Bible in the hand I had brought out from behind my back. I'd set out just to bring my New Testament, which I had won for memorizing the most Psalms in the Thursday night youth fellowship competition. I managed 8, although most of them except the 23rd had floated out of my mind in a week's time. But the little red Testament didn't seem like enough when you were maybe going to face the devil himself, not even when the words of Jesus were marked out in red ink. My father looked at the old Bible, swelled with family documents and pictures, and I thought he'd tell me to put it back, but he didn't. A look of mixed grief and sympathy crossed his face, and he nodded. "All right," he said. "Does your mother know you took that?" "No, sir." He nodded again. "Then we'll hope she doesn't spot it gone before we get back. Come on, and don't drop it." Half an hour or so later, the two of us stood on the bank looking down at the place where Castle Stream forked, and at the flat place where I'd had my encounter with the man with the red-orange eyes. I had my bamboo rod in my hand. I'd picked it up below the bridge, and my creel laid down below on the flat place. Its wicker top was flipped back. We stood looking down, my father and I, for a long time, and neither of us said anything.
"Opal, diamond, sapphire, jade, I smell Gary's lemonade."
That had been his unpleasant little poem, and once he had recited it, he had thrown himself on his back, laughing like a child who has just discovered he has enough courage to say bathroom words like shit or piss. The flat place down there was as green and lush as any place in Maine that the sun can get to in early July. Except where the stranger had lain. There the grass was dead and yellow in the shape of a man. I looked down and saw I was holding our lumpy old family Bible straight out in front of me with both thumbs pressing so hard on the cover that they were white. It was the way Mama Sweet's husband Norval held a willow fork when he was trying to douse somebody a well. "Stay here," my father said at last, and skidded sideways down the bank, digging his shoes into the rich, soft soil, and holding his arms out for balance. I stood where I was, holding the Bible stiffly out at the ends of my arms like a willow fork, my heart thumping wildly. I don't know if I had a sense of being watched that time or not, I was too scared to have a sense of anything except for a sense of wanting to be far away from that place and those woods. My dad bent down, sniffed at where the grass was dead, and grimaced. I knew what he was smelling, something like burnt matches. Then he grabbed my creel and came on back up the bank, hurrying. He snagged one fast look over his shoulder to make sure nothing was coming along behind. Nothing was. When he handed me the creel, the lid was still hanging back on its cunning little leather hinges. I looked inside and saw nothing but two handfuls of grass. "Thought you said you caught a rainbow," my father said. "But maybe you dreamed that, too." Something in his voice stung me. "No, sir," I said. "I caught one." "Well, it sure as hell didn't flop out, not if it was gutted and cleaned. And you wouldn't put a catch into your fisher box without doing that, would you, Gary? I taught you better than that."
"Yes, sir, you did, but—"
"So if you didn't dream catching it, and if it was dead in the box, something must have come along and eaten it," my father said. And then he grabbed another quick glance over his shoulder, eyes wide, as if he'd heard something move in the woods. I wasn't exactly surprised to see drops of sweat standing out on his forehead like big, clear jewels. "Come on," he said. "Let's get the hell out of here." I was for that, and we went back along the bank to the bridge, walking quick without speaking. When we got there, my dad dropped to one knee and examined the place where we'd found my rod. There was another patch of dead grass there, and the lady's slipper was all brown and curled in on itself, as if a blast of heat had charred it. While my father did this, I looked in my empty creel. "He must have gone back and eaten my other fish, too," I said. My father looked up at me. "Other fish?" "Yes, sir, I didn't tell you, but I caught a brookie, too, a big one. He was awful hungry, that fella." I wanted to say more, and the words trembled just behind my lips, but in the end, I didn't. We climbed up to the bridge and helped one another over the railing. My father took my creel, looked into it, then went to the railing and threw it over. I came up beside him in time to see it splash down and float away like a boat, riding lower and lower in the stream as the water poured in between the wicker weavings. "It smelled bad," my father said, but he didn't look at me when he said it, and his voice sounded oddly defensive. It was the only time I ever heard him speak just that way. "Yes, sir." "We'll tell your mother we couldn't find it if she asks. If she doesn't ask, we won't tell her anything."
"No, sir, we won't."
And she didn't, and we didn't, and that's the way it was. That day in the woods is 81 years gone, and for many of the years in between, I have never even thought of it. Not awake, at least. Like any other man or woman who ever lived, I can't say about my dreams, not for sure. But now I'm old, and I dream awake, it seems. My infirmities have crept up like waves which will soon take a child's abandoned sandcastle, and my memories have also crept up, making me think of some old rhyme that went in part, "Just leave them alone, and they'll come home, wagging their tails behind them." I remember meals I ate, games I played, girls I kissed in the school cloakroom when we played post office, boys I chummed with, the first drink I ever took, the first cigarette I ever smoked, corn shuck behind Dickie Hammer's pig shed, and I threw up. Yet of all the memories, the one of the man in the black suit is the strongest, and glows with its own spectral haunted light. He was real. He was the devil. And that day I was either his errand or his luck. I feel more and more strongly that escaping him was my luck, just luck, and not the intercession of the God I have worshipped and sung hymns to all my life. As I lie here in my nursing home room, and in the ruined sandcastle that is my body. I tell myself that I need not fear the devil, that I have lived a good, kindly life, and I need not fear the devil. Sometimes I remind myself that it was I, not my father, who finally coaxed my mother back to church later on that summer. In the dark, however, these thoughts have no power to ease or comfort. In the dark comes a voice which whispers that the 9-year-old boy I was had done nothing for which he might legitimately fear the devil either. And yet the devil came. And in the dark I sometimes hear that voice drop even lower, into ranges which are inhuman. Big fish, it whispers, in tones of hushed greed, and all the truths of the moral world fall to ruin before its hunger. Big fish. The devil came to me once, long ago. Suppose he were to come again now. I am too old to run now. I can't even get to the bathroom and back without my walker. I have no fine large brook trout with which to propitiate him either, even for a moment or two. I am old, and my creel is empty. Suppose he were to come back and find me so, and suppose he is still hungry.
That you love will be carried away. Read by Peter Garrity.
It was a Motel 6 on I-80 just west of Lincoln, Nebraska. The snow that began at mid-afternoon had faded the sign's virulent yellow to a kinder pastel shade as the light ran out of the January dusk. The wind was closing in on that quality of empty amplification one encounters only in the country's flat midsection, usually in wintertime. That meant nothing but discomfort now. But if big snow came tonight, the weather forecasters couldn't seem to make up their minds, then the interstate would be shut down by morning. That was nothing to Alfie Zimmer. He got his key from a man in a red vest, drove down to the end of the long cinder block building. He had been selling in the Midwest for 20 years and had formulated 4 basic rules about securing his night's rest. First, always reserve ahead. Second, reserve at a franchise motel if possible. Your Holiday Inn, your Ramada Inn, your Comfort Inn, your Motel 6. Third, always ask for a room on the end. That way the worst you could have was one set of noisy neighbors. Last, ask for a room that begins with a 1. Alfie was 44, too old to be fucking truck stop whores, eating chicken fried steak, or hauling his luggage upstairs. These days, the rooms on the first floor were usually reserved for non-smokers. Alfie rented them and smoked anyway. Someone had taken the space in front of room 190. All the spaces along the building were taken. Alfie wasn't surprised. You could make a reservation, guarantee it, but if you arrived late... Late on a day like this was after 4 p.m. You had to park and walk. The cars belonging to the early birds were nestled up to the gray cinder block and the bright yellow doors in a long line, their windows already covered with a scrim of light snow. Alfie drove round the corner and parked with the nose of his Chevrolet pointed at the white expanse of some farmer's field, swimming deep into the gray of day's end. At the farthest limit of vision, he could see the spark lights of a farm, In there, they would be hunkered down. Out here, the wind blew hard enough to rock the car. Snow skated past, obliterating the farm lights for a few moments. Alfie was a big man with a florid face and a smoker's noisy respiration. He was wearing a top coat, because when you were selling, that was what people liked to see, not a jacket. Storekeepers sold to people wearing jackets and John Deere caps. They didn't buy from them. The room key lay on the seat beside him. It was attached to a diamond of green plastic. The key was a real key, not a mag card. On the radio, Clint Black was singing Nothing But the Taillights. It was a country song. Lincoln had an FM rocker now, but rock and roll music didn't seem right to Alfie. Not out here, where if you switched over to AM, you could still hear angry old men calling down hellfire. He shut off the engine, put the key to 190 in his pocket, and checked to make sure he still had his notebook in there, too. His old pal. "Save Russian Jews," he said, reminding himself. "Collect valuable prizes." He got out of the car and a gust of wind hit him hard, rocking him back on his heels, flapping his pants around his legs, making him laugh a smoker's surprise rattlebox laugh. His samples were in the trunk, but he wouldn't need them tonight. No, not tonight, not at all. He took his suitcase and his briefcase out of the back seat, shut the door, then pushed the black button on his key fob. That one locked all the doors. The red one set off an alarm, what you were supposed to use if you were going to get mugged. Alfie had never been mugged. He guessed that few salesmen of gourmet foods were, especially in this part of the country. There was a market for gourmet foods in Nebraska, Iowa, Oklahoma, and Kansas, even in the Dakotas, although many might not believe it. Alfie had done quite well, especially over the last 2 years as he got to know the market's deeper creases. But it was never going to equal the market for, let's say, fertilizer, which he could smell even now on the winter wind that was freezing his cheeks and turning them an even darker shade of red. He stood where he was a moment longer waiting for the wind to drop. It did, and he could see the spark lights again, the farmhouse. And was it possible that behind those lights, some farmer's wife was even now heating up a pot of cottager split pea soup, or perhaps microwaving a cottager shepherd's pie or chicken francais? It was. It was possible as hell. While her husband watched the early news with his shoes off and his sock feet on a hassock, and overhead their son played a video game on his GameCube, and their daughter sat in the tub, chin deep in fragrant bubbles, her hair tied up with a ribbon, reading The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman, or perhaps one of the Harry Potter books, which were favorites of Alfie's daughter, Carlene. All that going on behind the spark lights, some family's universal joint turning smoothly in its socket. But between them and the edge of this parking lot was a mile and a half of flat field, white in the running away light of a low sky, comatose with the season. Alfie briefly imagined himself walking into that field in his city shoes, his briefcase in one hand and his suitcase in the other, working his way across the frozen furrows, finally arriving, knocking. The door would be opened and he would smell pea soup, that good hearty smell, and hear the KETV meteorologist in the other room saying, "But now look at this low pressure system just coming over the Rockies." And what would Alfie say to the farmer's wife? That he just dropped by for dinner? Would he advise her to save Russian Jews, collect valuable prizes? Would he begin by saying, "Ma'am, according to at least one source I've read recently, all that you love will be carried away"? That would be a good conversation opener. Sure to interest the farmer's wife in the wayfaring stranger who had just walked across her husband's east field to knock on her door. And when she invited him to step in, to tell her more, he could open his briefcase and give her a couple of his sample books, tell her that once she discovered the cottager brand of quick-serve gourmet delicacies, she would almost certainly want to move on to the more sophisticated pleasures of ma mère. And, by the way, did she have a taste for caviar? Many did, even in Nebraska. Freezing. Standing here and freezing. He turned from the field and the spark lights at the far end of it and walked to the motel, moving in careful duck steps, so he wouldn't go ass over tea kettle. He had done it before, God knew, whoops-a-daisy in 50 motel parking lots. He had done most of it before, actually, and supposed that was at least part of the problem. There was an overhang, so he was able to get out of the snow. There was a Coke machine with a sign saying, "Use correct change." There was an ice machine and a snacks machine with candy bars and various kinds of potato chips behind curls of metal like bedsprings. There was no "Use correct change" sign on the snacks machine. From the room to the left of the one where he intended to kill himself, Alfie could hear the early news, but it would sound better in that farmhouse over yonder. He was sure of that. The wind boomed. Snow swirled around his city shoes, and then Alfie let himself into his room. The light switch was to the left. He turned it on and shut the door. He knew the room. It was the room of his dreams. It was square. The walls were white. On one was a picture of a small boy in a straw hat, asleep with a fishing pole in his hand. There was a green rug on the floor, a quarter inch of some nubbly synthetic stuff. It was cold in here right now, but when he pushed the high heat button on the control panel of the climatron beneath the window, the place would warm up fast, would probably become hot. A counter ran the length of one wall. There was a TV on it. On top of the TV was a piece of cardboard with one-touch movies printed on it. There were twin double beds, each covered with bright gold spreads that had been tucked under the pillows and then pulled over them, so the pillows looked like the corpses of infants. There was a table between the beds with a Gideon Bible, a TV channel guide, and a flesh-colored phone on it. Beyond the second bed was the door to the bathroom. When you turned on the light in there, the fan would go on, too. If you wanted the light, you got the fan, too. There was no way around it. The light itself would be fluorescent with the ghosts of dead flies inside. On the counter beside the sink, there would be a hot plate and a Proctor Silex electric kettle and little packets of instant coffee. There was a smell in here, a mingling of some harsh cleaning fluid and mildew on the shower curtain. Alfie knew it all. He had dreamed it right down to the green rug. But that was no accomplishment. It was an easy dream. He thought about turning on the heater, but that would rattle too, and besides, what was the point? Alfie unbuttoned his topcoat and put his suitcase on the floor at the foot of the bed closest to the bathroom. He put his briefcase on the gold coverlet. He sat down, the sides of his coat spreading out like the skirt of a dress. He opened his briefcase, thumbed through the various brochures, catalogs, and order forms. Finally, he found the gun. It was a Smith & Wesson revolver, .38 caliber. He put it on the pillows at the head of the bed. He lit a cigarette, reached for the telephone, then remembered his notebook. He reached into his right coat pocket and pulled it out. It was an old spiral, bought for $1.49 in the stationery department of some forgotten five and dime in Omaha or Sioux City, or maybe Jubilee, Kansas. The cover was creased and almost completely innocent of any printing it might once have borne. Some of the pages had pulled partially free of the metal coil that served as the notebook's binding, but all of them were still there. Alfie had been carrying this notebook for almost 7 years, ever since his days selling universal product code readers for Simonix. There was an ashtray on the shelf under the phone. Out here, some of the motel rooms still came with ashtrays, even on the first floor. Alfie fished for it, put his cigarette on the groove, and opened his notebook. He flipped through pages written with 100 different pens and a few pencils, pausing to read a couple of entries. One read, "I sucked Jim Morrison's cock with my pouty boy mouth. Lawrence, Kansas." Restrooms were filled with homosexual graffiti, most of it tiresome and repetitive. But pouty boy mouth was pretty good. Another was, "Albert Gore is my favorite whore, Murdo, South Dakota." The last page, three-quarters of the way through the book, had just two entries. "Don't chew the Trojan gum, it tastes just like rubber. Avoca, Iowa." And, "Poopy doopy, you so loopy. Papillion, Nebraska." Alfie was crazy about that one. Something about the I-E, I-E, and then, boom, you got Y. It could have been no more than an illiterate's mistake. He was sure that that would have been Mara's take on it. But why think like that? What fun was that? No, Alfie preferred even now to believe that IE, wait for it, Y was an intended construction. Something sneaky but playful, with the feel of an E.E. Cummings poem. He rummaged through the stuff in his inside coat pocket, feeling papers, an old toll ticket, a bottle of pills, stuff he had quit taking, and at last finding the pen that always hid in the litter. Time to record today's finds. Two good ones, both from the same rest area. One over the urinal he had used, the other written with a Sharpie on the map case beside the Havabite machine. Snacks, which in Alfie's opinion vended a superior product line, had for some reason been disenfranchised in the I-80 rest areas about 4 years ago. These days, Alfie sometimes went 2 weeks and 3,000 miles without seeing anything new, or even a viable variation on something old. Now two in one day. Two on the last day. Like some sort of omen. His pen had Cottager Foods, the good stuff, written in gold along the barrel next to the logo, a thatched hut with smoke coming out of the quaintly crooked chimney. Sitting there on the bed, still in his topcoat, Alfie bent studiously over his old notebook so that his shadow fell on the page. Below Don't Chew the Trojan Gum and Poopy Doopy You So Loopy, Alfie added, Save Russian Jews, Collect Valuable Prizes, Walton, Nebraska. And All That You Love Will Be Carried Away, Walton, Nebraska. He hesitated. He rarely added notes, liking his finds to stand alone. Explanation rendered the exotic mundane, or so he had come to believe. In the early years, he had annotated much more freely, but from time to time, a footnote still seemed to be more illuminating than demystifying. He starred the second entry, All That You Love Will Be Carried Away, Walton, Nebraska, and drew a line 2 inches above the bottom of the page and wrote, To read this, you must also look at the exit ramp from the Walton rest area back to highway, i.e., at departing transients. He put the pen back in his pocket, wondering why he or anyone would continue anything this close to ending everything. He couldn't think of a single answer. But of course, he went on breathing, too. You couldn't stop it without rough surgery. The wind gusted outside. Alfie looked briefly toward the window where the curtain, also green, but a different shade from the rug, had been drawn. If he pulled it back, he would be able to see chains of light on Interstate 80, each bright bead marking sentient beings running on the rod of the highway. Then he looked back down at his book. He meant to do it all right. This was just, well, breathing, he said, and smiled. He picked his cigarette out of the ashtray, smoked, returned it to the groove, and thumbed back through the book again. The entries recalled thousands of truck stops and roadside chicken shacks and highway rest areas the way certain songs on the radio can bring back specific memories of a place, a time, the person you were with, what you were drinking, what you were thinking. Here I sit, broken-hearted, tried to shit but only farted. Everyone knew that one. But here was an interesting variation from Double D Steaks in Hooker, Oklahoma. Here I sit, I'm at a loss, trying to shit out taco sauce. I know I'm going to drop a load, only hope I don't explode. And from Casey, Iowa, where SR-25 crossed I-80. My mother made me a whore, to which someone had added in very different penmanship, If I supply the yarn, will she make me one? He had started collecting when he was selling the UPCs, noting various bits of graffiti in the spiral notebook without at first knowing why he was doing it. They were just amusing, or disconcerting, or both at the same time. Yet little by little he had become fascinated with these messages from the interstate, where the only other communications seemed to be dipped headlights when you passed in the rain, or maybe somebody in a bad mood flipping you the bird when you went by in the passing lane pulling a rooster tail of snow behind you. He came gradually to see, or perhaps only to hope, that something was going on here. The E.E. Cummings lilt of Poopy Doopy, You So Loopy, for instance, or the inarticulate rage of 1380 West Avenue. Kill my mother. Take her jewels. Or take this oldie. Here I sit, cheeks a-flexin', giving birth to another Texan. The meter, when you considered it, was odd. Not iams, but some odd triplet formula with the stress on the third. Here I sit, cheeks a-flexin', giving birth to another Texan. Okay, it broke down a little at the end, but that somehow added to its memorability, gave it that final mnemonic twist of the tale. He had thought on many occasions that he could go back to school, take some courses, get all that feet and meter stuff down pat, know what he was talking about instead of running on a tightrope of intuition. All he really remembered clearly from school was iambic pentameter. To be or not to be. That is the question. He had seen that in a men's room on I-70, actually, to which someone had added, "The real question is who your father was, dipstick." These triplets now, what were they called? Was that trochaic? He didn't know. The fact that he could find out no longer seemed important, but he could find out, yes. It was something people taught. It was no big secret. Or take this variation, which Alfie had also seen all over the country. Here I sit on the pooper giving birth to a Maine state trooper. It was always Maine, no matter where you were. It was always Maine state trooper. And why? Because no other state would scan. Maine was the only one of the 50 whose name consisted of a single syllable. Yet again, it was in triplets. Here I sit, on the pooper. He had thought of writing a book, just a little one. The first title to occur to him had been, "Don't look up here, you're pissing on your shoes." But you couldn't call a book that. Not in reasonably hope that someone would put it out for sale, in a store anyway. And besides, that was light, frothy. He had become convinced over the years that something was going on here, and it wasn't frothy. The title he had finally decided on was an adaptation of something he'd seen in a rest area toilet stall outside of Fort Scott, Kansas, on Highway 54. "I Killed Ted Bundy, The Secret Transit Code of America's Highways," by Alfred Zimmer. That sounded mysterious and ominous, almost scholarly. But he hadn't done it. And although he had seen, "If I supply the yarn, will she make me one," added to "My mother made me a whore," all over the country, he had never expounded, at least in writing, on the startling lack of sympathy, the just deal with it sensibility of the response. Or what about "Mammon is the King of New Jersey"? How did one explain why New Jersey made it funny, and the name of some other state probably wouldn't? Even to try seemed almost arrogant. He was just a little man, after all, with a little man's job. He sold things, a line of frozen dinners, currently. And now, of course, now. Alfie took another deep drag on his cigarette, mashed it out, and called home. He didn't expect to get Maura, and didn't. It was his own recorded voice that answered him, ending with the number of his cell phone. A lot of good that would do. The cell phone was in the trunk of the Chevrolet, broken. He had never had good luck with gadgets. After the beep, he said, "Hi, it's me. I'm in Lincoln. It's snowing. Remember the casserole you were going to take over to my mother? She'll be expecting it. And she asked for the Red Ball coupons. I know you think she's crazy on that subject, but humor her, okay? She's old. Tell Carlene Daddy says hi." He paused, and then for the first time in about 5 years added, "I love you." He hung up, thought about another cigarette, no worries about lung cancer, not now, and decided against it. He put the notebook open to the last page beside the telephone. He picked up the gun and rolled out the cylinder, fully loaded. He snapped the cylinder back in with a flick of his wrist, then slipped the short barrel into his mouth. It tasted of oil and metal. He thought, "Here I sit about to cool it, my plan to eat a fucking bullet." He grinned around the barrel. That was terrible. He never would have written that down in his book. Then another thought occurred to him, and he put the gun back in its trench on the pillow, drew the phone to him again, and once more dialed home. He waited for his voice to recite the useless cell phone number, then said, "Me again.
Don't forget Rambo's appointment at the vet day after tomorrow, okay? Also, the sea jerky strips at night. They really do help his hips. Bye.
He hung up and raised the gun again. Before he could put the barrel in his mouth, his eye fell on the notebook. He frowned and put the gun down. The book was open to the last four entries. The first thing anyone responding to the shot would see would be his dead body, sprawled across the bed closest to the bathroom, his head hanging down and bleeding on the nubbly green rug. The second thing, however, would be the spiral notebook, open to the final written page. Alfie imagined some cop, some Nebraska state trooper who would never be written about on any bathroom wall due to the disciplines of scansion, reading those final entries, perhaps turning the battered old notebook toward him with the tip of his own pen. He would read the first three entries, Trojan gum, poopy doopy, save Russian Jews, and dismiss them as insanity. He would read the last line, all that you love will be carried away, and decide that the dead guy had regained a little rationality at the end, just enough to write a halfway sensible suicide note. Alfie didn't like the idea of people thinking he was crazy. Further examination of the book, which contained such information as, Medgar Evers is alive and well in Disneyland, would only confirm that impression. He was not crazy, and the things he had written here over the years weren't crazy either. He was convinced of it. And if he was wrong, if these were the rantings of lunatics, they needed to be examined even more closely. That thing about, don't look up here, you're pissing on your shoes, for instance. Was that humor? Or a growl of rage? He considered using the John to get rid of the notebook, then shook his head. He'd end up on his knees with his shirt sleeves rolled back, fishing around in there, trying to get the damn thing back out, while the fan rattled and the fluorescent buzzed. And although immersion might blur some of the ink, it wouldn't blur all of it, not enough. Besides, the notebook had been with him so long, riding in his pocket across so many flat and empty Midwest miles. He hated the idea of just flushing it away. The last page, then? Surely one page, balled up, would go down. But that would leave the rest for them. There was always a them to discover. All that clear evidence of an unsound mind. They'd say, lucky he didn't decide to visit a schoolyard with an AK-47, take a bunch of little kids with him. And it would follow Maura like a tin can tied to a dog's tail. Did you hear about her husband, they'd ask each other in the supermarket? Killed himself in a motel? Left a book full of crazy stuff? Lucky he didn't kill her. Well, he could afford to be a little hard about that. Maura was an adult, after all. Carlene, on the other hand, Carlene was... Alfie looked at his watch. At her JV basketball game, that's where Carlene was right now. Her teammates would say most of the same things the supermarket ladies would say, only within earshot and accompanied by those chilling seventh-grade giggles, eyes full of glee and horror. Was that fair? No, of course not. But there was nothing fair about what had happened to him either. Sometimes when you were cruising along the highway, you saw big curls of rubber that had unwound from the recap tires some of the independent truckers used. That was what he felt like now. Thrown tread. The pills made it worse. They cleared your mind just enough for you to see what a colossal jam you were in. But I'm not crazy, he said. That doesn't make me crazy. No, crazy might actually be better. Alfie picked up the notebook, flipped it closed, much as he had flipped the cylinder back into the .38 and sat there, tapping it against his leg. This was ludicrous. Ludicrous or not, it nagged him. The way thinking a stove burner might still be on sometimes nagged him when he was home. Nagged until he finally got up and checked and found it cold. Only this was worse. Because he loved the stuff in the notebook. Amassing graffiti, thinking about graffiti, had been his real work these last years. Not selling price code readers or frozen dinners that were really not much more than Swanson's or Freezer Queen's and fancy microwavable dishes. The daffy exuberance of Helen Keller fucked her feller, for instance. Yet the notebook might be a real embarrassment once he was dead.
It would be like accidentally hanging yourself in the closet because you were experimenting with a new way of jacking off and got found that way with your shorts under your feet and shit on your ankles. Some of the stuff in his notebook might show up in the newspaper, along with his picture. Once upon a time, he would have scoffed at the idea, but in these days, when even Bible Belt newspapers routinely speculated about a mole on the president's penis, the notion was hard to dismiss. Burn it, then? No. He'd set off the goddamn smoke detector. Put it behind the picture on the wall? The picture of the little boy with the fishing pole and the straw hat? Alfie considered this, then nodded slowly. Not a bad idea at all. The spiral notebook might stay there for years. Then someday in the distant future it would drop out. Someone, perhaps a lodger, more likely a maid, would pick it up, curious, would flip through it. What would that person's reaction be? Shock? Amusement? Plain old head-scratching puzzlement? Alfie rather hoped for this last, because things in the notebook were puzzling. "Elvis killed Big Pussy," someone in Hackberry, Texas had written. "Serenity is being square," someone in Rapid City, South Dakota had opined. And below that, someone had written, "No, stupid. Serenity equals VA squared plus B. If V equals serenity, A equals satisfaction, and B equals sexual compatibility." Behind the picture, then. Alfie was halfway across the room when he remembered the pills in his coat pocket. And there were more in the glove compartment of the car, different kinds, but for the same thing. They were prescription drugs, but not the sort the doctor gave you if you were feeling, well, sunny. So the cops would search this room thoroughly for other kinds of drugs. And when they lifted the picture away from the wall, the notebook would drop out onto the green rug. The things in it would look even worse, even crazier, because of the pains he had taken to hide it. And they'd read the last thing as a suicide note, simply because it was the last thing. No matter where he left the book, that would happen. "Sure as shit sticks to the ass of America," as some East Texas Turnpike poet had once written. "If they find it," he said. And just like that, the answer came to him. The snow had thickened, the wind had grown even stronger, and the sparklights across the field were gone. Alfie stood beside his snow-covered car at the edge of the parking lot, with his coat billowing out in front of him. At the farm, they'd all be watching TV by now. The whole fam-damly, assuming the satellite dish hadn't blown off the barn roof, that was. Back at his place, his wife and daughter would be arriving home from Carlene's basketball game. Maura and Carlene lived in a world that had little to do with the interstates, or fast food boxes blowing down the breakdown lanes, and the sound of semis passing you at 70 and 80 and even 90 miles an hour like a Doppler wine. He wasn't complaining about it, or hoped he wasn't. He was just pointing it out. "Nobody here, even if there is," someone in Chalk Level, Missouri had written on a shithouse wall. And sometimes in those rest area bathrooms there was blood. Mostly just a little, but once he had seen a grimy basin under a scratched steel mirror, half filled with it. Did anyone notice? Did anyone report such things? In some rest areas, the weather report fell constantly from overhead speakers, and to Alfie, the voice giving it sounded haunted, the voice of a ghost running through the vocal cords of a corpse. In Candy, Kansas, on Route 283 in Ness County, someone had written, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock," to which someone else had added, "If you're not from Pudlisher's Clearing House, go away, you bad boy." Alfie stood at the edge of the pavement, gasping a little because the air was so cold and full of snow. In his left hand, he held the spiral notebook, bent almost double. There was no need to destroy it, after all. He would simply throw it into Farmer John's east field, here on the west side of Lincoln. The wind would help him. The notebook might carry 20 feet on the fly, and the wind could tumble it even farther before it finally fetched up against the side of the furrow and was covered. It would lie there buried all winter, long after his body had been shipped home. In the spring, Farmer John would come out this way on his tractor, the cab filled with the music of Patti Loveless, or George Jones, or maybe even Clint Black, and he would plow the spiral notebook under without seeing it, and it would disappear into the scheme of things. Always supposing there was one. Relax, it's all just the rinse cycle, someone had written beside a payphone on I-35, not far from Cameron, Missouri. Alfie drew the book back to throw it, then lowered his arm.